another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, the respect is going out. The respect is going out in hindsight and in remembrance of Staff Sergeant Paul Lyons, who was co-host on this program, and we lost Paul, as everybody knows, a couple weeks ago. Denise, are you here today?
I am here, Doug.
Great, fantastic. Ray, are you here today?
I am. Thank you, Doug.
Great. Hey, Kathy and Lloyd, are you there by any chance? Okay, well, Denise, can you fill us in a little in this nightmare that we've been living in, where we need to go and what you think needs to be done and the way out?
Well, with the situation with those that are giving up, and Paul had given up, one of the things that he had called the helpline, the crisis line, but all the crisis line can do is talk to people. We need people that are able to respond in person, and not just the policeman being called. Policemen can do little. You know, they can talk to the person, but they're not trained in stress reduction or anything else. And so we really need people that can mobilize and get to a vet and sit with them and convince them to go in for help and to get them in. Paul was there alone. His family was elsewhere. And this happens with our vets. And we have to do something more substantial for those that we know are at high risk, that have talked about it, that are intent on, you know, just leaving us behind and going wherever. And there has to be a better system to reach out to these people, even mobilizing from a local clinic or mobilizing from the, you know, VA hospital, have a team going out and being there with that vet and convince them to come in. I mean, we have to make an effort. Yes, we can get them to go in, they may get treatment and then do it anyway. But we have to at least make a better effort to reach our veterans that are on the edge. And veterans that have been taken in and been turned away, that's got to stop. I mean, period, end of story. If you don't have a place for them in that VA hospital, you make a place, you put them in the hospital, or you get them to the nearest treatment center by ambulance. You don't turn them loose. They're being brought in by their parents or their friends, and this has got to stop. There's got to be a better protocol, and there's got to be hope for our guys, and there is a little hope, especially if they live in a rural area. Paul lived out in Henderson, Arkansas, you know, which was quite a ways from probably the nearest VA hospital in Fayetteville or even Little Rock. So there is a problem there, and we need to address it and have a plan, have a protocol. I was told by the crisis line people they had crisis teams in some locations. I imagine it's probably in metro areas. I don't know the whole list of it. But, you know, we've got to make better plans for these guys, get a chaplain out to them, get a psychiatrist or a nurse. That is a vet also. We can do better, and we haven't done better.
Yeah. It's been a nightmare because I know when this all transpired and Paul cried the crisis line and that failed, then he called to you and you called to me and we activated our chaplain here, Brian Manigold. Thank God he got to Brian within minutes. He was 100 miles away. And then what I learned from the crisis hotline, and they called me, by the way, the supervisor called me last night as a follow-up, and then I reminded him, I said, this all fell apart. And what I have learned from the crisis hotline is if you call on a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday or something, or call in the middle of the night, they do a referral back to your primary care physician at your VA where you're getting care from or wherever they can, but that doesn't happen on a weekend until the following Monday, and it doesn't happen until the morning in the evening. And so, I mean, it's been a nightmare. Ray, you know, since we met and you came in with us and joined us, I mean, you become a brother, but you and Johnny, you guys got firsthand experience in dealing with this and going to responding, don't you?
We do. We're trying to get everything organized. We are trying to create a new protocol and a plan of action that not only I'm supposed to meet with Johnny Mundy and some other folks, and we're going to try to get something to as many people as we can that will give them a plan of action. Johnny has been working with police departments, medical folks, all these different people that have no she was just talking about. They don't really know what to do or say, and they feel inept, and they just want to kind of pass you along, hang up on you, or just get away from you because they feel like you're in a dangerous position, and you might take them with you in, as far as litigation and those type of things. So what we have to do is we have to create a protocol that people can go by, and it's a real thing. The people that we work with are combat veterans. All of us have dealt with suicide. We've all dealt with hard times, and we know how to get through some of it. And so what we do is combine our efforts together, and we're able to reach out to a lot of folks with help and hope that sometimes is not available in other ways. Sometimes the veteran doesn't want to connect with people that he feels like has never been where he is. And you really don't know what I'm feeling. You don't know what I'm thinking about. Well, there is a lot of us, Doug, including yourself and Denise and all of us, that have been there, and we can reach out with them, with helpful information and trying to get them some help wherever they are. So working out pretty good.
Well, I have to say that Paul called me, and then he told me he wanted to talk to the crisis line and tell him how it's to be a vet that's dying. And the denials. We have to talk about the moral wounds we have done to our Gulf War vets, and we did it to Agent Orange vets and Atomic vets, too, of, saying that nothing happened. It's been in the newspaper recently of the ones from OIF that had chemical exposures from the IEDs. It's been in the New York Times, in the Newsweek. This isn't new news for Doug and I that the exposures happen. We've had news stories before. Our government has not acknowledged. We fought them until 08 to get them to quit saying that this exposures was stress, that it was real.
Right.
But anyway, Paul did call the hotline at the same time. I gave him the number. He told me he was going to call him. I called him and asked for them to patch me into the police in Henderson, which they did. And, they did get out to the house because I was back on the phone with Paul immediately, keeping him talking to me. And, I heard the door knocking on the door and Paul saying, go away, go away. And I kept telling him, this had happened 15 years ago with Paul, the same scenario. And telling him that
15 years ago, we had in the middle of the night also, and you called me, and we got one of the chaplains on call at Fort Campbell to respond in the middle of the night to his quarters. And that time we were able to save him, but the abandonment and how sick he was, and he couldn't get care, and all the work he had done for everybody else that he saw nothing happening to, no matter how many efforts, it pushed him over the edge.
Right.
Yeah, the moral injury that you've talked about in the last several shows, Doug, is truly there. I mean, we've got illnesses. Our bodies are going down on us. In fact, I think I've heard of five in the past couple of weeks that have died. One needing a lung and heart transplant. I mean, these are seriously ill people that have not been acknowledged. None of this has been acknowledged truly by every daggum provider, VA nurse, clerk, at the VA. I have to tell people when I went out for the med study in Minneapolis VA, that's the only time that I have heard, and it was everyone I met there for that study saying, we are sorry for the way VA is treating y'all. This is real. It is serious. We apologize. We're not like that. And they meant it. Every one of them said that to the vets. And it wasn't just me. It was everybody. It starts with an acknowledgement that goes all the way up and down the chain. then we can work on corrective actions. Until that happens, we're tied up with doctors not even acknowledging that there's illnesses from these exposures. They may not understand it, but say, I understand your illnesses from the multiple exposures you had. I understand. I'm going to try to do everything I can. What test would you like? And making every effort to that veteran and his family members, who's speaking up for him many times, to get him the test, to get him a referral to war-related illness, and not, you know, having a vet go to the doctor at the VA and saying, I want a referral, and then the doctor going, I don't know what that's about. That is totally unacceptable. Totally.
No, Doug, I sent you an email a while ago. I don't know if you got it or not, but it was a quote from President George Washington. Did you receive that?
Yeah, I sure did. And, I mean, it goes back to day one that, you know, the future wars and defense of our nation and everybody coming up depends on how well we're treated. And I have to say, from Vietnam forward, and even back to the Korean War, the vets have been treated horribly. I mean, I grew up with that when my dad was a veteran service officer in Lake County in Illinois, and so I saw it. I was growing up, and I didn't realize it until after I came back from Vietnam and saw the abandonment around Agent Orange, and then it's continued on to this day. Kathy and Lloyd, are you there yet by chance?
They did the same thing in World War One with the mustard gas. You know, they didn't know or they didn't care for these guys appropriately. I mean, that was decades ago, but World War One was mustard gas huge. You know, you never hear about that. And those of us that are vets try to teach other school children and young adults that this is not appropriate how the veterans are treated when they come home and have to go into the VA system and they have the doctors. You know, Foy Overstreet was an atomic vet. You know, I went down, you know, drove nonstop from Denver to Amarillo to get to him when he was in the hospital. And they had him on a room down at the end of the hall. And I tell you, this guy was septic. He was dirt spacing where you have fluids going out into your surrounding body tissues. And they were not treating him aggressively. He's an atomic vet. We did get it out of his doctor that their records are at the Justice Department. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, but for years, they ignored.
You know, the horror about this thing is when you get the crisis mode, and that's where the other guests that I've been asking if they were going to join us, and they were going to try to join us today, they also, you know, because they're right here in Illinois in Rantoul, and one of the problems they ran into, Lloyd had put in his claim a long time ago, over a year ago, and hadn't heard anything, couldn't get anything done. And about 2 weeks ago, Friday, they found out that his claim was shoved in the files at the VA, in the VA office, and never processed. I mean, just shoved in a pile in order to avoid it because it was so strong. And again, it revealed the horrors of what had gone on in his unit and what had happened to him afterwards. And so that's been stirring up a firestorm here. And it's all tied together. So when they can't get medical care, they're denied the stuff, they know they're sick or they can't get, you know, something happened, the families are disarray, and all they're done is shoved away and said, hey, it's all in your mind, just get over it. No wonder they turn into a crisis. And then the thing that's horrible, and Ray, you brought this up earlier today, when we look at the enlistments and the people we've got in the volunteer military, way too many of them have come into the military with incredible baggage all around them, no family support network. They've already got alcohol and drug problems, I mean, incredible waiver numbers. And then they put them into a situation like this, and all you're doing is lighting the wick on a firestorm.
Exactly.
And not only that, Doug, but talking to Doug's family, is he had accidental overdoses, you know, accidental, yeah, he self-medicated with alcohol. He had an alcoholic father. Then the drugs the VA gave, which were just psychiatric drugs and pain drugs.
Well, that is horrible when you mix alcohol and mix the psychotropics and the pain drugs together. You can't mix those together.
And then talking to the Whitcombs, because Paula Ben Preston of the DSJF, Desert Storm Justice Foundation, and talking to them and finding out that, you know, I knew Jason had committed suicide, but I didn't know he had several attempts before. Dadgummit, it, VA, if you've got your family members, give, you know, you've got to interview the family members and get the complete history. And each time they attempt, a risk or higher of saving these people, they need to be mandated into an alcohol treatment program first off. Mandated. This is the plan. You're going to go through this. Then we're going to put you inpatient PTSD program. And we're going to make it happen. We're going to give you every support. And then we're going to deal with your health issues, too. There has to be a plan. There is no plan to respond the moral issues that are created when your government's not even acknowledging your exposure. It just it makes it even worse.
Doug, you know, when you have veterans doing alcohol and drugs, before or after military or during military, you have to look at the cause sometimes. And a lot of times it started out in high school or junior high school, and it began with a social kind of thing. But, you know, because of trauma is so prevalent in homes today, kids are trying to self-medicate before they ever finish high school. They are really, it's not about a social thing anymore. It's about self-medicating and trying to feel better about yourself. Trying to be social, you know, it goes with two beers, you feel, two drinks, you feel funny and laughable, and you're the clown of the party. But two more beers, you're starting to get obnoxious, and then two more beers, you throw up on somebody. And it just creates more trauma in their lives. I talked with about 80 junior ROTC students yesterday. I spent all day at a high school, and we were talking in four different classes. And I talked to them about substance abuse, and mainly alcohol and drugs, prescription drugs, because that's the two things that they have access to more than a lot of other things. It does get into hard drugs and stuff, but these kids are probably the best in the high school. These kids are trying to do something with their lives, and they have a goal they're trying to meet. But it's so easy to be distracted by things, and you want to be social, you want to be friendly. So they're getting in with crowds, and so there's a whole program that I feel like the good Lord gave me and developed it, and it's called Watch Out for the Hooks. And the hook means addiction. And we used to look at people and say, man, that guy's hooked or something. But that's exactly what it is. It is like a hook that is inside of you that will control you and make you do things or make you not do things that you're supposed to. When they join the military, they're trying to get a better life. But even the military has parties where they bring a truck out with, you know, beer on it and everything. The only condition nowadays, like at Camp Lejeune, they have to have equal amounts of soda pop. But there's no limit as far as age and all that stuff. They're all 18, 19, 20 years old. And so what they're doing is really, you know, adding fuel to the fire like you just talked about.
Well, I know my own cousin, he was with the 82nd Airborne. He was a medic and went up into Iraq during Desert Storm. And they got back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and they brought in a Huey, you know, with a whole net full of booze and beer and everything. And then they had a party, and then they allowed everybody to drive. And in his case, he was drunk and everything else. They didn't take the keys away, and they're all partying. He got in a car and didn't get hired any place at all and got a horrible accident with a brain injury.
Right.
I mean, he's 100% now, but we had a nightmare getting his disability.
Yeah.
But then the alcohol ever since, because of the trauma and the medical problems, the alcohol has come into play. And I know, you know, when he lived with me and lived with us here for 3 months, you know, we had no access to alcohol at all. So there was no way for that to fall back on.
Yeah.
And these individuals, and I know Paul, I mean, Paul went back to the alcohol and he'd got away and he went back to it. Because everything that was happening and it all falling apart, you know, we read his last, you know, the email, we read it last in the last show we did, read his email, but that horror that I keep picking up all over the place is, well, they got the meds and they misuse them, they don't understand them and they misuse them, they can't get away from it, so they go to the alcohol, they got all these problems before they get into the military, and then they're compounded when they get out, they can't get a proper job, they can't get an education. I mean, it's back to, I mean, when you said George Washington's thing there, I mean, if we don't treat them right, who's going to come?
That's right. That's right. And I'm sure they're having consequences because of that. George Washington said, the willingness with which our young people are likely to serve in any war, no matter how justified it is, shall be directly proportional to how they perceive the veterans of earlier wars are treated and appreciated by their nation. That's an awesome statement, you know, and people can look back and say, look, these guys are struggling. I don't think I want to be part of this thing. And I know everybody has baggage, but, you know, there are certain ways you can. If they know a guy has got a real alcohol problem, I really think the medication he's being given should be limited. It should be counted. It should be made sure that he doesn't, and the whole family needs to be brought in and maybe made aware that he is playing with a stick of dynamite here, and he could go out of here, or he could really, you know, cause a lot of damage if he goes crazy on you. You know, post-traumatic stress, it has a lot of side effects to it, like hyperventilate, aggression, claustrophobia, irritability, tunnel vision, fear, hypervigilance. And when you when you're feeling all that and you take alcohol or drugs to try to calm down, it really just exacerbates the whole situation, and you begin to act irrationally and things. So it's really a problem that I think that a lot of us have to get our hands dirty and get in this thing and try to reach these veterans with some help and hope and try to get them to limit what they're doing, destructive behavior, because they're going to continue to die as long as they keep giving them pills and letting them drink and letting them do these things. And it's really affecting the entire families.
Didn't Johnny say the suicide rate was something like 27 to 30 a day now?
Well, somebody said 27. 27 a day, and I'm not sure if that's an exaggerated figure. I know it was 22, but I could imagine 27. And like I say, you know, 59 on the suicide watch at Camp Lejeune. No telling how many bases have even numbers higher than that. Because the guys come back, and you know, we suffered the same things when we came back home. You got a lack of excitement, a lack of adrenaline pumps. You're not able to really communicate with people anymore, and you know, your buddies spread out. They're all over the place, and so you can't really get up with them, and you're just left to your own devices. And so you drink to, when you isolate, and that's what everybody does with post-traumatic stress, seem like. They want to get away from everybody because their nerves are just gone awry. And they try to get away from everybody, but when they go away from everybody, they take alcohol and drugs with them. And that's where you find a lot of people just slipping over the edge because they didn't mean to. They just didn't want to feel what they were feeling, or they didn't want to remember what they had to remember.
And I mean, so they don't know what's happened to them. I mean, as I've seen as a medic in my work, and Denise, you've seen it, and we've talked about it, and all three of us have seen it and talked about it and been there. When you start combining the alcohol and the drugs and the medications and all these other problems, you don't recognize what's happening to you or recognize what's happening around you when it's all coming apart. I mean, it's like it's coming apart and you don't know what's coming apart, that you need help. I mean, that's
well,
the horrible
like,
thing.
I know the wife told Paul he needed to get help. He didn't.
She told me that, too. I mean, that was our conversations.
And, you know, she feels bad, you know. She had to leave him and take the kids. And that's another trigger that happens is when the families break up, you can almost anticipate it happening.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I said, you know, the history taking by the VA nurses and, you know, talking to the family, even if they're estranged, to get the history of what's really going on. And sitting those out down and go, okay, we're going to have a treatment plan. You've got to cooperate. This is what we're going to do. You know, you're abusing alcohol. We need to detox you from that. And then we need to, you know, deal with your PTSD. At the meantime, we can also be testing you for your physical illnesses. We're not denying those at all, you know, and that's what's got to be stated. We're not denying those, but in order to treat them, we got to turn your body around a little bit and have these other substances out of your body so that we can work on it and have a positive result or a better result. And I don't see that happening. I really don't. Well, if they get into a PTSD, you know, in-house program. And so we're missing a lot of them. And it's almost like, you know, before they're allowed to leave the military. It's like, don't let them leave, you know. If we know these problems are there, you know, mandate them. We're going to keep you on the salary, but, you know, we want to, you know, have you get the right things in life. We have a debt to owe to you, and we're going to help you get there.
The other
problem, I think, is this horrible things on nutrition. I mean, we've talked about it, and these vets don't have a proper diet, so they can't have proper healing. And then they got too much alcohol and their improper diet, and then they don't have proper hygiene. I mean, all of us have fought that forever. Both Denise, you and I, both as medics in the front line and everything else, I mean, we had a nightmare just trying to keep people proper hygiene. And then they got sick, and then it just comes, the whole thing comes apart.
Yeah. Well, I know it does. And, you know, I put more things on my website all the time for the people who will go to my website because of the book. But I'm putting things about Watch Out for the Hook, which is about substance abuse. I'm going to put more information about that so they can. Sometimes you have to be able to see yourself in order to make a decision to do something about it. You look in a mirror, your hair is messed up, you need a shave, you're going to need a bath, and you see yourself. And so sometimes we need a reflection of our own selves. And I'm going to try to add more to my website because it is reaching people. But there's other things about signs of suicide and things that people can read and say, you know, my dad is really in that condition, or my brother or my father or my sister or my mom or somebody. But they can recognize those things about a suicidal person, and maybe they can help them. You know, the family really needs to be part of this thing. And if we can get them to help out and maybe see things building up, and you know, if a guy has certain signs about he's starting to be really lonely and isolated, and he's got survivor's guilt, and he begins to use substance or maybe continue, but he begins to become, there's a thin line between use and abuse, first of all. But there's a lot of things that they're doing in their life. They're talking about suicide. They're talking about being with their dead buddies. They're stockpiling weapons, stockpiling pills. And there's a lot of evidence, Doug and Denise, that we can see. And if we see that, we're the ones that need to be calling the VA and say, look, my dad's in a problem here. Because they have to do something. If you make a call, it's in their court. And they're going to have to do something. And so you can glean help like that sometimes just by making it a conscious thing that everybody can see. The VA will have to do something. So
I have to hand it to one of our Vietnam vets, Vic Sylvester, a parent of a Gulf War vet. And his idea when they started closing bases was keep some of that housing for the veterans. You would take care of some of the homeless issue. Keep the, you know, hospital open, turn it into a treatment center for the vets, and that was never done. You know, we had housing available that was turned back over to state or city government and should have been used, you know, by the vets.
You know, one thing I was thinking right now, and just with my own experience, especially in the other ones, when you get to your doctor, whether it be a VA doctor or a military doctor, there has to be a bond or a relationship developed, and there has to be a trust there, and the doctor has to acknowledge what's happening and look at you and build a trust. But what I've seen so many times, and the experience I've had so many horribly times in other ones, is that doctor's got that desk between you and him, and he's got his head stuck in the computer. He's not looking, listening, or touching. And geez, when you've done and taught medicine forever and ever and ever, if you don't listen and touch, you ain't got anything, do you?
No. You got to have that eye-to-eye communication. You've got to have the caring nature. You know, you have to do the probing with the family or the vet and really find out what's going on. I mean, there was some, in every one of these cases, you can see the triggers. You can see the problems just mounting up from the denial of what happened to us to the moral injury there to the PTSD to the use of, self-medication to the family falling apart. I mean, Paul had gone through that twice. You know, you can see it. You can go, they're at a high risk. Put a score on them for high risk, and everybody pay attention to that. Of course, you're probably going to miss some of the ones that are quiet, withdrawn. But that's why you have to get the families involved. And I feel so bad for the families. I mean, the family members with Paul knew their dad's history, knew somewhat Paul's, and yet they didn't think he'd do it. You know, you never want to think somebody's going to do it. But, you know, it's not just the wife or the estranged wife, it's the kids, it's the sisters and brothers, even if they don't live in that area. They should be contacted and let them know. You know, it's got to be an agreement with the patient that you can do that, but, you know, you need the, you know, blood relatives also involved to know that this is happening. Y'all want to be involved. Do you want to help? You know,
right.
They were totally caught off guard, as happens with suicides. And, you know, my heart went out to the youngest sister. You know, she and Paul were the youngest ones. And, you know, to the older sister that lived in Fayetteville. But they didn't know how bad it was, or they didn't put it together.
Well, there's, you know, that family denial thing is in there where you don't want to look at the problems, but then the vet denial is in there, and then the medical denial.
Exactly.
And it just boils over. I mean, I got to really come to it and come back to this a little bit, but I think the more I listen and the more I think and the more I feel and go back on myself, this moral injury or this injury to the soul is so deep ingrained at the core of all of the problems, because with this moral injury coupled with the physiological injury, you're setting up a thing for failure from the beginning, and somehow we've got to get by that and cure that and get acceptance such that the medical treatments will work. But then the doctors have to, I mean, absolutely have to acknowledge and admit. I mean, on my own team, I still can't get the VA to even acknowledge it. Lieutenant Colonel Bill Laurel, who died from cancer, got all that stuff doing the work for us. I mean, he was there, and they said, well, he wasn't there, and you guys weren't there, and you didn't do it. I mean, hello, here's where the photographs show you were there. The records have been destroyed. The medical records were deliberately destroyed. Denise, when you talked to the command staff from Desert Storm, the medical staff, you found out firsthand yourself that they loaded everything and was destroyed when they opened at Connex, didn't you?
Yep, I did.
And that's what's happening. That in the New York Times story that broke out here in the last few days has totally acknowledged that. We've known it from day one. I mean, Andre said that, and he tried to get care for everybody. I mean, Andre said that at CDC. I distinctly remember him telling everything in the world. And Kilpatrick and Dax and Cherry went absolutely bonkers.
That's amazing.
You know, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, you know, you're talking about moral injury, and, you know, we are made up of three parts, body, mind, and spirit. And the VA has just really started recognizing that because it's really an internal thing that we have to deal with sometimes. And like I told you before, I wanted peace, but I didn't know how to get peace. You can't buy it. You can't borrow it. You've got to have it for your own self. And, you know, I tell people a lot of times to go to church if they, you know, not in a crisis situation. I don't talk like that. Thing about it, going to a church is you're hanging around good, pretty good, decent, honest people for the most part, and you know who you hang around has a lot to do with who you are. If you're hanging around negative people and they're always talking down on stuff, you're going to be more depressed. And so, what you need to do, pardon me, you need to choose your friends wisely, because you'll probably end up like them. I know that's a simple thing to say, but it's a real, real thing to do. Because who you hang around really has a lot to do with the way you think and the way you act and the way you do things. And so we have to make better choices. And family can have a good part of that, too. You know, and so it's not a big deal. It's a little deal, but we need to talk about it more.
Well, the other thing we have to talk about is, you know, we have seen with the OIF and OEF, they have done a lot more for them. And Memorial Day, Veterans Day, they're talked about. They forget to bring in World War II vets, Korea vets, Somalia, you know, each of the veterans that have participated in armed warfare, you don't leave out anybody in that recognition. And I've watched them in the Memorial Day ceremonies from D.C., and I go, again, they didn't mention Desert Storm. Again, they didn't mention Somalia. Again, they didn't mention Grenada or Panama. I mean, how long does it take to get that message out and have those people, even if you have to fly them up there, get donations, you know, have them there in the audience, have some of them standing up and have, you know, their family member of somebody lost or somebody that has died since to say some words like they have in the program. You can never, never, never leave any veteran or any error, you know, or war out of this. And you see that happening. They forgot about the Korean War vets forever and a decade. The atomic vets, the Agent Orange vets, the vets that have had illnesses from contaminated bases. You know, they don't talk about that. They don't say that. It's like it's a black wound on the government because they didn't acknowledge it. Well, it's time for that to stop. And I don't know who we have to talk to. If we have to go to the White House and have a conference at every change of White Houses, and we have to have a conference where they come to us on the Hill instead of us running around trying to get through all the halls, and the movie people and the stars that get involved and say, you cannot leave out any group of veterans. You cannot. It is being disrespectful, you know, if you omit them.
Denise, it's been several years ago, my wife, 4th of July evening, my wife wanted me to sit down with her and watch the program, 4th of July, I think it was Pop to the 4th, but I'm not sure exactly what it was. They were up in Washington, D.C., they were out on the lawn, they were singing, they were playing. So I sat down, didn't really want to, but I did. And they were singing a song, When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again. They were playing it, and they had pictures of wars as they were doing this. And they had World War II, then they had Vietnam, then they had Gulf War, and then they moved right along. And what they didn't do, they didn't have Vietnam. And it slapped me right in the face, just about. I thought about it later. I thought, Johnny didn't come marching home with Vietnam. He comes straggling home. And it would have been a hypocrisy had they done that. But how many guys did it smack in the face with that, who was already depressed or something, and then they feel so unused, and they feel abused, and they feel all these other things that are taking place. And then with the physical injuries and physical ailments, it just compounds everything. And that was in Washington, D.C., you know, and it's like, how could they do that to us? But that's the way it was. You know, and they would really be hypocritical had they put on there, Johnny came marching home from Vietnam. He didn't. They say, we lost the war. I didn't lose the war. I thought I did pretty good. And I think you guys did, too. So I think our government lost the war, but the people who were fighting the war didn't lose it.
You know, I think with that thing, though, and the horrible thing that we're seeing today is, I mean, you'll get a flash in the pan, and they'll talk about it on the news or in the newspaper or on radio or TV. But you don't have any real lasting coverage or any emphasis on fixing the problems and identifying what the problems really are. It's like the general public and the news media, they don't want to talk about this. I mean, it's the horrors of this and the consequences are so horrible that it's not talked about. It's hidden. And I know all of us, and Denise, you've been absolutely instrumental in getting the information out. I mean, Gary Noll, God bless Gary. He did the film, ladies and gentlemen. You need to get that from his website. Gulf War Illness, Killing Our Own. Get the one from Joyce Riley, Beyond Treason. There's been so many documentaries out there, but even the vets don't have them, and they're not shared, and the doctors don't see them, and the families don't see them.
I see Gary Noll appearing on public TV about health issues, but our documentaries have never been shown on PBS even. You know, everybody's got a PBS station in their town. You know, there's other ways to get it on if the national media won't cover it. And there just needs to be a coming together. And I know we've got some capable veterans from every war willing to come together and work this problem. But, you know, there's the acknowledgement needs to come from the government on Gulf War veterans and the exposures. It's criminal. It's misconduct. I would almost say it's treason, you know, to turn your back on the soldiers and have this go on 25 years and have a denial rate of 80%.
Crazy.
You know, the benefit of the doubt was supposed to go to that. I don't see that happening.
Well, I think their logic is eventually we'll go away, and they're hoping that we will do it sooner than later. But as long as there's folks like Doug and Denise and these others that are still crying out for this, I'm working on the other end. I'm trying to reach kids and young people before they go in the military. I'm trying to reach them after they're in the military to make them aware of what's going on around them. If they're contributing to it, they're really causing their own demise. And so, I'm trying to reach them in that way. My book is, I've had many therapists to tell me that when they read my book, it helped change their therapy. People able to identify with the military so much better than what they generally see. Like Doug talks about, you know, Rambo and all this stuff. That's what they think. But we're real people that are being affected in real ways, and it's causing a lot of problems, and they need to understand that. Maybe they will.
I know a nurse that was sitting in the hospital was an advocate for us, served over there, flight nurse. And I know when our OA report came out from the Research Advisory Committee, and we were working the media, the vets, to get it out there and going to stations up in D.C. to get it, you know, interviews. And she was sitting in a hospital bed dying, and she made everybody quiet down. She heard it come on. She saw it. They said it was real. She kind of flipped the bird at him with her finger, as told to me by her son. That had been years after the fact, you know, of some little acknowledgement. It wasn't from the government, but it was from a research advisory committee. And so we worked very hard to try to get the media to follow suit. And I've been to RAC meetings since. The only person we have seen media-wise was Kelly Kennedy. I think her name is, another one's Patricia, I think, or Priscilla, with the military side. We don't have the Washington Post sitting in the room. We don't have CNN sitting in the room. This is a meeting that happens quarterly. And, you know, it's announced in the Federal Registry. They should know. They have not shown no cameras, no nothing. You know, to show that there's researchers that believe in us and are trying to get answers for us. And unless you can get the vets up there in person, which they're suffering, and financially they're suffering, to get them up there to make a public comment, or at least have time to meet these people in person and know that the researchers are not in it for the money. They're trying to help us. And our vets have turned against a lot of times our research if they just pay us our compensation. Well, there's two different pots of money always. And to tell them to not be for the research that has been proving the point, even though some of them have been small scale, small in numbers, we are proving the point that the damage is done. Listen up. That's what the Agent Orange people had to do with finding that dioxin in the fat. And to turn our vets into thinking that the researchers are out after money and to pad their curriculum is unbelievable. I mean, each of the researchers I've met that are involved in Gulf War illness, and some of them we pulled from civilian chronic fatigue world, are really trying to get answers and trying to get to the point that there are some legitimate treatments to help. And, you know, they've got a hyperbaric clinic set up in Oklahoma, privately funded. They're doing that for TBI, but they're also using it for Gulf War vets. Can help with the PTSD. People are trying. But, you know, unless our media follows the story, puts the pressure on the government. You know, like Doug and I have said, we've known this since the beginning. We've been out there fighting since the beginning to get the truth out and get the appropriate help. But it starts with an acknowledgement, a full acknowledgement from the government, from the highest person to the lowest post in the totem pole, you know, to know that this is real and this is how you're going to greet these vets when they come into the VA. You're going to acknowledge them. You're going to say, I'm sorry, we believe you. You know, we're going to try to do everything we can and quit tying their hands. We had doctors that were fired from the VA, and I know that that happened with the Vietnam vets, too. Doctors trying to speak up when the word was out, don't speak up. And, you know, they spoke up from their conscience. Dr. Carini Ball spoke up, and he paid the price with his promotion that he had. We had an insider that was a Vietnam vet Marine from inside the VA trying to help us, and they threatened him over and over again. You know, and you threaten them, and they've got a family to raise. He had, I think, 5 kids in college, and they were threatening his livelihood, his job.
I mean, he did everything he could, and he was specifically instrumental in getting Jim Toot and getting his report out. I mean, he was a deep throat for Jim Toot.
Right. We had several deep throats. We had them in the Pentagon, in the CIA with the Eddingtons. I mean, and, you know, Eddingtons wrote a book, trying to get the truth out. The group that formed on the anthrax vaccine, the pilots over in Connecticut speaking out. I'm shaking my head. Blumenthal was the attorney general in that state before he got elected to Congress. And he's not leading the charge in Congress saying, hey, you know, we need to look at these that, you know, we're non-deployed and sick and sorted out as if the vaccine or not. But there's a lot of money, as we know, with the DU weaponry, with the vaccines, you know, with the chemicals. I mean, we gave the chemicals. You know, it's pretty common knowledge among the vets. We gave them the chemicals. We knew they were there. And, you know, we air-bombed them. And if you look at the Regal report, that stuff doesn't burn. Is vaporized. I call it the biggest friendly fire we ever had in this country, I think.
That's what it boils down to. I mean, the majority of the casualties now from Vietnam onward are all friendly fire. And the moral injury is these wars weren't directed at anybody that posed any threat to our freedoms or our government or anything else, but it was economic and political control. And the casualty numbers are staggering. But then, too, and it bothers me horribly because I hear about it day after day in my travels, I learned it, the civilians, whether they be in Jefferson Proving Ground, Indiana, or on the main island of Hawaii, or Schofield Barracks, or Vieques, or up there in Massachusetts, and then all these non-combatants in these nations we've destroyed, their health effects are staggering, and there's just complete denial and disavowing any need to clean it up, even though it's mandated by their own regulations that come on down. General Shinseki signed. Oh, man, I get flustered beyond comprehension. Was it, Denise, 1999, we went to Institute of Medicine before the whole board, and you presented at that time how to fix this problem.
Yeah, wrote each point down of what they needed to do from step A to step whatever. I think I had 26 points on that, and none of them was picked up and done. I mean, they're not even tagging the vets on their computer system now. This is an Agent Orange vet. This is a Gulf War vet with exposures. A non-deployed with, you know, exposures from the equipment coming home. You know, we had the old folders in with the medical records, and I said, tag those daggone folders with a big sticky placard on the front of them. You know, that when you pick that up as a doctor, you know who you're dealing with. And to think that the vets don't know, and they're just not respecting the veterans' knowledge. you know, no matter what rank they were, they learned. I mean, I was impressed at my first meeting I went to in April of 94 when Bethesda had a hearing on the health consequences of the Gulf War. I was amazed at some of our sergeants and all that had dug in and done their research and knew daggum well and could speak. And, you know, I was so proud of them. You know, they may have been a trucker or, you know, transportation or supply person, but they had dug into it. And, you know, we're still picking up those that just thought they were getting old, you know,
right,
and had all these problems. And the critical nature of it is to have wives developing problems in the children. And this happened, Gulf War, that the children were affected generationally. It happened with the atomic vets. We had a bill to at least have a registry, and they timelined it and, you know, didn't get renewed, that we can't even get those records into play and have a tracking system. You know, you can't tell me the VA doesn't have a tracking system to tell us how many, you know, have this diagnosis or have had heart problems or heart transplant or lung transplant. And, you know, it's a shame, because if they don't know, they don't go to the VA and don't establish a C-file number, which is your claim file, when they die, I've gone to the state health department and talked to them about death certificates. And unless there's a C-file number, they don't even know it's a veteran, much less what war or what era. And, you know, that needs to be changed. Your states and every level of government have to put on a death certificate. This was a veteran that served during this time, whether they have a C-file or not. And, you know, I cannot believe that we have National Security Agency that can screen every phone call made between countries and here in the U.S., and we can't have a good tracking mechanism, and we can't even get decent numbers out like we used to with the Gulf War veteran, data. You know, they sabotaged that. We were getting it quarterly, and they sabotaged that. It got so bad they had to, I guess. But, you know, we don't know a full count on the death, and that should be public knowledge. Public knowledge, because your doctors need the info. They need to know. There's a need-to-know principle here. What were the exposures, you know, and how many have died and of what, so that we can look at a vet and say, we need to do these studies on you. We need to check out your heart. We need to check out your kidney. We need to check out your liver. We need to be sure you don't have an aneurysm, you know, and we need to look at your lungs closely because the oil fires, you know, and everything that went on. They, you know, they don't have the knowledge because it's been blocked at the top.
Well, we all know that the baby boomers have quit paying their taxes so much because they're all retiring. And not to give the government any kind of slack there, I know the funds aren't there because there's too many government programs taking that away from the veterans. But they ought to prioritize, because if you don't take care of the veterans, you're not going to have anybody to fight the wars coming up. It will be a no-show for a lot of people.
In about 96, when we had this going strong, I knew from the recruiting command they were having trouble meeting their recruiting goals.
Right.
We
right.
were having an impact. And that was in the mid-90s that we were having an impact. And, you know, so they knew we were impacting by being out there in the press and speaking and investigations going on. And I guess they had to squash it because they wouldn't have recruits. We talked
about the demographic data rated, I think, earlier today in response to your Washington letter. I mean, it shows there, when you look at the recruiting demographics for 2010, the people that they brought in and enlisted in the military had a nightmare problems before they came in, and they sure didn't have optimal educational preparation. And when they did the ASVAB and the AFQT and all this stuff, it showed up that they didn't even have that 100% capability to learn because they didn't have the background necessary in education. I mean, that's what we're seeing today. These kids are getting out of the military, and jobs and everything are evaporating Well, the military doesn't prepare you for a civilian job. And even the utmost in the medics or the chemical field, the training you get in the military is not much more than one or two semesters in college. Well, how are they going to get an education? And then they come down with the incredible respiratory, neuromuscular, and memory problems.
They're not employable because people with the way things are today, and there's so many people in line to get a job that are qualified, those guys at the back of the line, it won't help them, nobody will help them, and they're out basically out there on their own working at Walmart. They can get a job. And they're hoping they'll go away one day, and they probably will.
Well, we have about 4 minutes left in the program, I believe, Doug, so
yep.
We need to kind of do a roundup of what we came out of today to talk with.
Well, Denise, why don't you do that, because you've been instrumental in this response for Paul and everybody else. Go ahead and round it up.
Well, we have to have better response, and it starts with the government's full acknowledgement after any episode and immediate response from the government, telling the truth, not hiding it from the American public or trying to hide it from the service members. They need to be out in front. I look at the Japanese and how they apologize publicly when things go wrong. And it's almost like we need that from the highest level of our government, DOD, CIA, the whole bunch of them need to form up and have a huge press conference and say, we have done wrong. We apologize. This is what's going on with our veterans. We want the American public to know. You know, you start it there, because then you've got, you know, congressmen and senators that will step up and say, yes, we need to look at the benefits for our veterans and what we're doing to help them. You have to heal that moral wound first. That is the first step. Then after that, you have to have treatment programs and availability to get those vets in, whether it's a family member. When I've heard that family members have taken their suicide potential member in and then come home, and the vet commits suicide within the week. I mean, this is, you know, you can't just limit it to the veterans. They got family members, and this spreads through the community. It gives us a distrust of the government. You know, you look at the things with National Security Agency, what they can do. What we could do is unlimited if we put our mind to it and are told the truth. Our medical people will step up just like they did for PTSD after the OIF, OEF. They opened their doors of, you know, 1 hour for the veterans, you know, donate your hour of time, donate this, donate that. The American people will respond. The medical people will respond. But we have to tell the truth. It starts with that. And until we get that, we're all going to be stuck in this quagmire that doesn't get better. And we lose more people.
Yeah, we can't lose anymore. I mean, Paul Lyons was a dedicated hero. I mean, he worked for veterans all over this nation for years, and he was sick himself. And he gave up. Ray, any last comment?
Doug, just continue on what you and Denise are doing, and I'm going to be working here, and Johnny's going to be working here. I know it seems a little fragmented, but, you know, you can burn a city down with a half a dozen matches if they're set in the right places at the right time, and I hope we're doing that.
Okay, God bless America, and take care. Ladies and gentlemen, the call for action. And Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, it's on you, sir. Take care.